Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. As always, I'm Anil Tripathi.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And today we have special guest back again, Ben Gibo.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, of course.
Good to have you on board again.
So, as you guys know from an earlier episode, Ben is a photographer by trade and profession. But what you might not know is that he's also an avid bicyclist and actually cycles to work.
Indeed, a true urban cyclist in the name right there. So we thought it would be kind of fun to kick off today. And Anil and I, we've been covering a lot of stuff on transportation in the past couple of weeks. And so we were talking with Ben, and it seemed like a really fun idea to sort of do an episode specifically on urban cycling. We thought of what better person to ask than the urban cyclist himself. So we kind of talk about, you know, whatever you like, your experiences of what it's like to be an urban cyclist. Like, you know, you actually commute, you bike to work, don't you? You know, like you don't have a car, you're a man of a bicycle. And so it'd be kind of cool to sort of share what it's like, you know, to be an urban bike cyclist in that case. And we'll throw some anthro speaking, some lenses out there and think through it together and build a new portrait of urban cycling, you know?
That sounds great. That sounds great. Well, yeah, thanks again for having me on. I think this is my third time being on here. So
trilogy.
Very excited to be here. So I've been living in Boston for maybe about 6 years-ish. I don't know, you kind of lose count after five. But so when I came here, I had a car, and I came here for photography school, even though I grew up in the area initially and I kind of moved around. But eventually came back here for photography school, had my car. I was in school for a year and a half until I graduated, and then I still had my car. I used it maybe once a week for a photo shoot or so, and then I started to get some problems with it. It would just stall out in the middle of intersections, and it was just a pain in the neck. So I decided I'm just going to get rid of it and just see if I can bike everywhere. My brother bought me a bicycle for Christmas, I think 3 years ago, and I was very tentative to use it in the city because I've always heard people getting into bike accidents and that sort of thing, and I was always very tentative. And so I was like, I'm just going to start out riding in bike lanes and then see how it goes. And then, like, almost immediately, I just became sort of obsessed with it. And I thought to myself, I was like, I'm glad I get rid of my car. I'm just going to see if I can get panniers for the back and just load my camera gear in there and then just bike to jobs. And it was probably one of the most liberating things I've ever done. And I've been biking to photography gigs for about 2 years or so and going strong. And a lot of people think, like, every time I go up, I try not to let my clients know specifically that I arrived on a bike, but sometimes I don't, you know, I'm there and I'm like, oh, I brought my bike, and they're like, oh, what are these bags? Like, oh, they're my panniers, you know? And this is where I keep all my bike gear. And everyone's always like, oh my God, you bike with all your camera gear? Aren't you afraid? It's like, well, I have insurance, and I always bike with a GoPro on my handlebar. So if I get sideswiped or someone hits me or something like that, I'll have the whole thing recorded, and then, you know, the situation will resolve itself.
It sounds like you have almost an added mystique, or, you know, almost an added benefit to your job, or, you know, a kind of a plus that you can show up in with a bicycle. And it almost sounds also right that for you, going to bicycling was actually safer than driving your old car.
Oh, it absolutely was. I think one of the best things about it is that when you're in a car, you never know, you know, especially with Boston, you never know the traffic situation. With a bike, I can get anywhere. Like, I know exactly how long it'll take me to get from one place to another. Every time, I'll be within just like 3 or 4 minutes earlier or later. And it's great. And you can park anywhere. You don't have to, you know, there are no bicycle parking garages. You can just park it on a sign and then you're good to roll. And other people think, oh, do you bike with all your camera gear, like, in the rain? Yes, I do. I have a full waterproof system. My panniers are completely waterproof. And from head to toe, I have, like, booties. I have, like, I'm waterproof from head to toe. So I guess the only, like, the main downfall when biking to a job is if it's, like, really raining, I don't know what to do with my my outer shell of, like, rainproof gear. I just kind of, like, let it sit on my bike outside. But other than that, you know, it's pretty seamless, and it's a great system that I have.
That's cool. So one of the things you mentioned, you said that it was a liberating experience, right? And I thought, I'm picking up part of that is because you can park anywhere, right? And then, like, traffic is different for you too, right?
Oh yeah, traffic's way different. So the reason why I would say it's liberating is because I'm not paying insurance on a car that's just sitting there that I use once a week or once every few weeks. And it's just a beautiful thing to be able to just get on my bike, you know, and make sure it's ready to rock and I'm ready to rock and roll. I can just check the brakes, check the chain, and okay, I'm ready to hit the road. And I get on the road, and if something happens, my chain falls off, whatever, I can just pull over, I can fix it, and I don't have to go to a mechanic and ask them what's wrong and then have to bring it down there and deal with all the pains of a car mechanic. I can just fix everything myself. I see all the components, I can see what's wrong, and I can just take care of it, and it's relatively cheap to maintain a bike yourself if you know how to do it.
So along with this liberating aspect, you also, it feels like you're kind of more self-aware and you're more in control, right? Whereas with a car, especially these days, you can't really fix anything yourself. So you have to go to a dealership automatically, but here you have complete control over your vehicle. You know how it works.
Exactly. It's and that is, I think, the most liberating thing about it. And the other thing is that if I do, I have most of my photo shoots are in Boston, and sometimes I'll have a big commercial shoot where I'll need a lot of photo gear, and my bike just can't. I can't carry everything that I have sometimes. So what I do is I'll use Zipcar, or actually the Zipcar equivalent, which is Hertz On Demand. Essentially just rent a car by the hour. It's great. I can bill my client. I don't have to pay for gas. It's perfect. So in situations like that, I can bring more camera gear than I'm willing to bring on my bike. But generally when I go on photo shoots, having my bike take everything that I have or take all my camera gear, it forces me to think more minimally, and I have to. So I go to the shoot, and I have like less lighting, I have less gear, and it allows me to build up more of a rapport with my subject, and I'm able to kind of like get the gear out of my mind and really be there for the person that I'm photographing, and if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It raises some interesting questions too, because I mean, Boston in general. I'm looking at a list of like bicycling.com's top 50 bike-friendly cities, and Boston's 26. Which is less, and this is
really?
Again, yeah. And
how old
different.
Was this article? Because recently, I remember reading something.
I bet it went up. This is looking at its last date I see here, and it's 2008. So it's been a couple of years.
Okay,
no, it's 2011. Sorry,
they're in top five now.
Good. So we're moving up, which that's what I was going to say. I think because this list does seem out of date in that way, because there has been really a lot of sort of either political movements, financial movements to sort of increase either bike lanes, bike safety for cyclists themselves, or just kind of different projects that we see an increasing profile of biking. I mean, even we can talk about, I mean, to get, I'm going to get too Bostonian here, but, you know, even like specific places near Central Square in Cambridge, I mean, they have the new bike lanes in which like it's the road, then the car parking, and then on the other side is the bike lane. There's not a lot of places in Boston that have that, but we are seeing these interesting initiatives that are literally changing the physical road itself to make it safer for bikers, right?
And I think, a lot of the awareness for these projects came from also just kind of the extreme consequence of a lack of safety for cyclists in the city, right? Where we had, a BU student being run over by a truck a couple years ago, and just these continued incidents of cyclist fatalities, right?
Yeah, I just read one a minute ago before we went on the air, and someone that was on a Hubway, one of the bike rentals, they got hit by, I think, a dump truck or something, and that was the fatality. So there are things to be aware of, and there is a lot that can be done as far as the infrastructure in Boston to help cyclists have more of a safe commute.
Have you seen much change in the city over the years that you've been cycling?
Yeah, I absolutely have. I've only been doing it, what did I say, just a few years. I've been really into it for a few years. But, yeah, more bike lanes. Cambridge just came out with on Western Ave in Cambridge, there's an actual dedicated bike lane that's part of the sidewalk, which I think is the most safest. It's the most safe bike lane possible, as opposed to just – having the divider or having just a line. It's actually up on the sidewalk, so it is elevated. And it's the first, at one of the streetlights, there's the first bicycle signal.
Oh, yes, yeah, I've seen that,
You guys saw that.
It's very cool.
That's great. And, I mean, this really plays to the fact that there's so many different ways we can incorporate cycling, right? I mean, around different streets, I know a lot of people have probably seen the pictures of the biker, the kind of minimalist stick figure drawing, right on the road where you can have a bike lane there. But then there's also the Copenhagen style of a bikeway, right, where you have parked cars, you have the road, parked cars, and then a bike lane. And that intuitively, I think that makes so much more sense to me, right? Because why should we be protecting parked cars more than people, you know, who are bicycling? And it kind of creates a natural buffer then between the sidewalk and cars themselves.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing to see. And I was actually doing some research for this episode, looking at different biking, you know, setups around the world. And in the Netherlands, you know, in Amsterdam and The Hague are some of the coolest and most progressive bike-friendly areas and, like, spaces. I mean, to the extent that, like, you know, cyclists themselves actually have right-of-way on the road there. And that, I mean, 70% of people in the Netherlands bike. So, I mean, they're obviously, of course, still cars, but even the street signs themselves had these cool things. They said that, you know, this is a bike street. Cars are guests. It's a really, really funny idea. Yeah, you know?
It kind of changes the way people are looking
right
at the right of ways. And, of course, also in the Netherlands, looking at the evolution of this biking culture.
Yeah.
So much of it began because of tragedy, right? Because of auto accidents. That spurred reform
in the 50s and 60s, right?
Bicycles.
Which is really interesting to think about, too, because you're right. Because at the same time that, you know, the idea of the American dream of, you know, want to have the white picket fence and your 2.5 kids and your dog in your car was the American thing. In the 50s and 60s, that was really pushed. But the Netherlands, you're right, because there was everywhere, really, when you see the rise of automobiles and driving, there's a huge increase of fatalities also related to automobiles. And that, you know, the Netherlands decided that they were not going to push that. They said, we're going to actually change our policies to push away from that kind of tragedy. Really, I mean, to the extent that's really fascinating, there's this movement that was called Stop the Child Murders, about kids that were killed in automobile fatalities. And so that sounds like that's a very strong name. You know, that you wouldn't see something like that in the U.S. Maybe we should, though. You know, maybe we need to work on our wording a little better or something. But, you know, to push to have more cycling as the primary mode of transportation. And now, as we're kind of saying, like, it's a really interesting shift that's different from how we see in the U.S., right?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, one of the things that I remember reading about is that, you know, I've never been, you know, to the Netherlands, but they don't even wear helmets over there because that's such the normal means of transportation. And they just go, you know, at a relatively, not a slow speed, but they go in just a, you know, a nice, easy pace, where here...
It's also very flat there, right?
So it's
famously flat, yeah.
That's true.
So the big fat tires come from, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Netherlands, yeah.
And people, I remember seeing, I saw a photo of a guy on his bicycle, and he was carrying a refrigerator on a trailer. I'm like,
oh, wow.
You can't have any excuse to drive to work with your with a purse or just like one briefcase if a guy's bringing a freezer or a refrigerator somewhere. So that's the other thing, is that in America, because there's this definitely car versus bicycle situation, bikers are much more aggressive, and myself included. Sometimes you have to, like, be the aggressor and, as I like to say, claim the lane. If there are two lanes going the same way, you know, I'm always worried about getting doored, because that's the one thing you can't anticipate, is somebody opening up their door. I've been doored two different times, and I've been hit on a couple other times as well. And considering how much I bike, I was thinking how small of a percentage it actually is, because I bike every day. So it's only just been a handful of times I've had these problems. But, you know, so we have to be very, you know, a lot of bikers are very aggressive because they're essentially a part of traffic. We're not pedestrians. We're like essentially a part of traffic. But what we need is to have something to kind of allow us to be our own means of transportation.
No, yeah. Completely. And I think also the kind of the need to have kind of a heightened aggression at this current time kind of reflects the fact that so many people just aren't used to it, right? So there needs to be this awareness, and there needs to be this everyday looking, right? Because in the past, when you opened a door, you never had to really worry, because chances were there's such a low probability there'd be a biker. But now, as more people biking, we need to adjust to this change, and we need to create a different type of awareness in our drivers, in our pedestrians, in our bicyclists.
Well, it's even like, I mean, because one of the things that makes me think of is of course, education, right? And so, you know, to jump back to the Netherlands for just a second, we can reflect on this in the U.S., like, it's something like 90% of some children in the Netherlands are taught sort of bicycle practices in school. It's a compulsory educational thing. Like, you learn that along with arithmetic and English or whatever, you know, obviously English and Dutch. And so, like, it's one of the subjects you do in school. And so it's really kind of interesting that it's bicycle safety, bicycle, you know, how do you ride a bike in a public area? And I wonder if you think about it, even in the United States, you know, we most of us go to driver's education, you know, around 15, try to get your license around 16. In the Netherlands, for one, you can't drive until you're 18. So obviously having a bike when you're younger gives you a new sense, a different sense of freedom, right? Because you don't have to worry about it if you can get a car.
And you think about the public funding in the U.S. that goes into driver's ed.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, police officer has to be there when you take your lesson occasion sometimes, right? So you have public funds going into these lessons. Mm-hmm. So, and then that creates the car culture, right? So we have different possible models of public funding that can create these very different scenarios of transportation.
Yeah, and so it's just something to kind of ruminate on. You know, it's like, would we? I mean, what would it mean if, like, even in driver's education, if there was a section? I don't remember honestly because you know it's been a while since I took driver's ed. But
I think all I watched in driver's ed was Oprah. Yeah. I mean, they had the Oprah series about drunk driving.
Oh yeah, don't drink and drive. Right? I wonder if like if they would do stuff that had to do with cycling culture too. I mean, particularly here in Boston, right, or other much more bike. And I'm from Texas, so it's very different anyway, which is something to think about by itself. But here, I would wonder if we could see something like that. You know?
Yeah, I think what I would like to see is getting a bike test done where you have the cop on your pegs on the back of the bike, and you can just ride around.
Yeah, right. Even it's interesting seeing like as we think about too, like what are police officers in terms of public safety, what are they moving around? And particularly on college campuses, you see bikes more often. But in general, you know, even here going downtown, you do sometimes see bike cops. Not too often, though.
I had an incident just yesterday where I came back from a bike ride, and my front bike was a little stuck. So I asked a police officer who's driving around in a large SUV and everything to help me out, and he said he just didn't know what to do because he'd never had a bicycle. You know, he'd never biked at all in his life. So I mean, I think, just being able to create multimodal transportation in the police force could have such an effect. I mean, also we have a situation where we have lots of very unhealthy police officers, right? Mm-hmm. There's a very, kind of alarming statistic of the number of police officers who pass away right after retiring because of the stress, because of the unhealthiness of the job. So if you think, if you can provide a healthier form of transportation, it could really help a lot of people out.
Yeah. My brother, who's a police officer in Rhode Island, there's behind where he works, there's a bike trail. It's a long bike trail that goes through his entire town. And the other day he did his first patrol on his bike, and he really enjoyed it. And it sounded like a lot of fun. I mean, I'd almost want to be a cop if I could ride around my bike all day and try to arrest teenagers or something like that.
Keep the peace while keeping the exercise, It's not a bad thing.
And you think also about that it's, cheaper to have a cop biking around versus driving around and burning gasoline. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a financial incentive here, I think, for police departments. Totally. And it's definitely cheaper than a horse, and we have the horse brigades. And
right.
Yeah. It's kind of weird they still have those. Why is that there? Just for like intimidation purposes?
Yeah, I think it might be some sort of a nostalgia effect as well.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. Every time I see a cop and a horse, I always just see them in a park talking to chicks. That's like the only time I see that happen.
Well, I think, jumping from horses, we can think, it kind of opens up the multimodal transportation aspect of all this. And I think, Ben, when you brought up the Zipcar example, I think that's so important, right? Because it's not just that we're asking people, to just be on bicycles all the time, right? We want to be able to provide people different forms of transportation in an efficient manner. Mm-hmm. There's a statistic, right? 90% of the time, cars are not in use. So there's, a massive amount of infrastructure, a massive amount of labor going into cars that then spend the vast majority of their lives dormant. So if you think about ways that we can implement car sharing, we could, really save a huge amount of resources. And Zipcar, Uber, all these different applications are, I think, creating this possibility in order to help people be more comfortable just owning a bicycle, right? So that they know they can get a car when they need it.
It's a great point to bring up, and that's something that one of my favorite philosophers, Jeremy Rifkin, brings up all the time when he's talking about sort of this zero marginal cost economy and one of his ideas is this question of access is kind of what you're both pointing at, and multimodal transportation is a big way to think about that in terms of that. You're right, Neil. It's not about getting people on bikes all the time. I mean, that would be a nice and be a much greener way to live. But what he's kind of points at is like what people nowadays. especially young people that are sort of like coming into their own in what is the world economy now, are looking for access to things. It's in some ways less about do I own my car, do I own this or that, or even like the Hubway bikes here in Boston, right? For a lot of people visiting, I mean, I see more and more Hubway users every day, and I think it's fantastic. You know, it's really cool to see that like people just need to have access to new kinds of things. In some ways, I mean, an example of this is this group called Cycle Chalao, and it's in Mumbai, and it's these two management students, and they basically did a bike share. They did the city's first bike share program in a suburb in Mumbai in India, and it had massive success. I mean, it's very small. Like, you know, Boston Hubway, the bike things probably have, like, I think it's like 10 to 15 bikes on a singular rack that you can rent at any one time. And Mumbai just had a single one of these racks. You know, Hubway's got, like, you know, 10,000 or something. But just to see how it worked, and in Mumbai, India traditionally is, like, super congested with cars, with rickshaws. And what they did, and to speak to the multimodal angle, is that a lot of people would, you know, then have to bus in from the suburbs to get to the city to go to work. And then usually because of congestion, because of traffic, they would just take their bus to point X and then have to take a rickshaw or a taxi then to get to their final destination. So what these two guys want to do with Cycle Chalao is then cut off that second thing. Like, you take your bus if you have to, but then instead of taking a taxi or rickshaw, then you can rent a bike.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a very interesting way of saying, like, as long as people have access to these multi-modes, it does actually reduce traffic, too. I mean, obviously, they're trying to scale up at this point. But it's a great question. It's a thing of access, right, that we need to be able to just have more options in this way. Mm-hmm. And then people can make – you can make better decisions, you know, once – you know, laws can help push things in different directions, of course. But
definitely. And also here we have issues of class perception, right? So in India, for a long time, you know, it was only people who were too poor to have a moped that would bicycle. But now there's this idea, especially for a lot of Indians being in the U.S. and Europe, they've seen, you know, bicycling as kind of a higher, you know, class thing to do now. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of helping get people involved with cycling. And I know there's a movie available on Netflix now called Urbanized, where the mayor of Bogota in Colombia was talking about issue.
Great film, yeah.
And how, you know, it's so hard to get people cycling initially because, you know, they thought it was, you know, a lower class thing. But then he made sure, you know, to create very nice bike paths and then not fund the roads, really. So you had, like, you know, dirty, you know, muddy roads versus the nice, clean bikeway. And at the same time, this promotes social integration, right? Because everyone can have access.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it might take, you know, kind of the beautifying and everything to get kind of higher class people to engage with it, you can then create an atmosphere where people of all classes can communicate with one another and you know, interact with each other.
Yeah, it is worth thinking about. I mean, particularly in urbanized, right, in Bogota, Colombia. Then we can compare that actually here, as we're saying, kind of in Cambridge and Somerville, where there is sort of a prestige added to if you're an urban cyclist, right? Because there is sort of an awareness of issues of you know, sustainability, of, as you said, sort of in some ways of liberation, right, that we're sort of decongesting traffic by being in a different mode of transportation. In some ways, riding a little bit safer because you have to be more aware. I mean, speaking of defensive driving and that kind of bike, you have to be doubly defensive, you know, or offensive in this case, too, by saying, you know, like, you can claim the lane like you're allowed to. And if you see on the streets, you know, they've got the lane, it's got the picture of the bike as well as the, like, you know, the middle lane saying the bike may use this full lane, to let drivers know that this is a shared lane system, you know, which is tricky. But you're right. It's like there's this, in some ways, interesting perception that, like, what direction are we going to see it move in? I hope, you know, because in China, which the UK used to call the Kingdom of Bicycles, which is kind of a cool title, you know, but bicycle riding has really been down since 1990. I think it was about 40% of people travel on bikes, and now it's down to 18 or something in China, because as economics rises, right, the idea of the car is a prestige item. Like, they would like to have the car versus the bicycle. Whereas in Cambridge and Somerville, we're seeing not necessarily the opposite, but we are seeing a push in the other direction, too. Same in Portland. I mean, a lot of these, like, the fact that there's so much emphasis on cycling in the U.S., Minneapolis and Portland, in Boston, you know, and so even in Austin, Texas, right? So, I mean, it does – there's directions that point towards it. So it's like kind of an interesting – depending on where you are in the world, too, like, who – what sort of class issues are showing up here, right?
Oh, yeah. And also with this, I think we have the issues of – I mean, in any case of consumption, there might be – some class differentiation and inequality in the consumption, right? So now even, you know, we have incredibly expensive bicycles that could be, you know, thousands of dollars. But still, in comparison to the inequality generated by cars, it's much less, right? I mean, you can't really compare a bicycle that's $5,000, you know, might be top of the line, to a car that's $40,000 or, you know, $80,000. Yeah. So even though there can still be disparity, it seems that we can really close it if we emphasize on bicycles versus automobiles.
Yeah. It does make you wonder in terms of class issues, right? And one of our listeners wrote to Danielle saying that, like, we have to be aware of, like, same in Thailand, too. A lot of stuff in Southeast Asia and East Asia, right? We are seeing these are issues of classes. And, like, it's a question of, like, what are you paying for? Because you can buy an expensive bicycle, too, right? I mean, you want to tell us a little bit about your bike, because you have a very nice bike that I've met a few times. It's a great bike, you know?
Oh, well, thank you.
And there's some prestige with that, too, right? Because it's, like, the kind of bike, the kinds of things you put on it, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I definitely don't. I'm not like a show off kind of guy with anything, but when it comes to my bike, I like to say drive a bike because you're actually powering the bike, and I like to say when you're in a car, you're not driving a car, you're riding a car, just
yeah,
doing all the
true.
Work. So the bike that I drive is a Surly long haul trucker. It's forest green. I got a nice Brooks saddle on it, and I got bamboo fenders, and I love it, man. I just love my bike, and it feels so good to just ride, get out in the streets, and you know, nothing better for me is getting out in the Boston streets at night on a summer night and just biking around, not really having any goal or any direction, and just riding, feeling the wind, and not having any cars, and it's a beautiful feeling.
Yeah. And I think this, I mean, your experience, it almost kind of lends itself to kind of a new American dream of transportation where you think of, you know, all the old films, you know, the open road, on the road,
yeah.
Which it's funny, right? Because the phrase on the road, a lot of people, it seems, connect it with cars and everything, right? But the majority of the time, Jack Kerouac was actually hitchhiking on buses or stealing cars. And then they'd take those cars. But it's fascinating, right? Because I think so much in really trying to get people engaged in social movements and transportation movements, you need a cultural basis to really kick this off. Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
One thing that I was thinking, or actually there were two things that I was thinking of, I think generally the thought in America is like, we want to have our space, we want to have, you know, we want something to be mine. And that's what the car symbolizes. You get it when you're 16 years old. It's the first sense of adulthood that you have. And
independence.
You get complete independence,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, so there's that. And then there's also the subconscious kind of thing where it's like, oh, well, bikes, that's what kids use. But it's those two things I think are starting to be like flip-flopped a little bit. Because when you're on a bike and you see other people on bikes, you can engage with them. But when you're in a car and somebody else in another car cuts you off, you're going to be giving them the finger and swearing at them. But if they just cut you in line at the supermarket, you would never say those things. So you're completely removing yourself from society in a way when you're in a car.
And we have to see the effects, I think, also. Because, I mean, there's this idea, right, you're 16 and you get this independence. But think about all the years before then when you're completely dependent because you don't have a car. And you're stuck in a neighborhood, you know, as I was growing up, where you can't go see anyone without a car. You know, it's just there was no bike-friendly area. If I, you know, the road right outside of my neighborhood was, kind of a busy route. So, you know, it wasn't really safe for a kid to kind of go biking there.
Even just taking it another way, where there are a lot of towns outside of Boston that don't even have sidewalks in suburban areas.
Yeah,
it's like if you have children, you're trying to, you know, walk your kids in a stroller, you're essentially, their car is going 40 miles an hour down winding roads and there's no sidewalks.
Exactly.
It's like,
that's crazy.
Really nice homes, but who built this? Who came up with this dumb idea?
Yeah, it's a very interesting, I mean, suburbia and urbanity, we keep saying we'll do a show on it eventually, right? Because it's totally worth thinking about because it's these great questions of like when you're talking about giant infrastructure like that. And that's what it's kind of cool to think about the film Urbanize, as you're saying, or even in Amsterdam or in Boston too. We are physically changing cement landscapes, you know, to make them more amenable. You mentioned Gabe Klein last week, talk about his work in Chicago and that how he, you know, was like both lauded and got a lot of flack because he was literally saying we need to make complete streets, which is a very cool idea. And complete offers space for multimodal transportations, pedestrians, cars, buses, bikes, segways, what have you, you know? Maybe even longboards, you know, who knows?
No, you name it. And now, luckily, I mean, especially around Massachusetts, we see a lot of local incentives to create, you know, more multimodal transportation, more bike lanes. In fact, even using, going back to transforming space from last week, using the abandoned infrastructure that we had in the past for transportation, the rail networks. You know, just yesterday I biked from Alewife to Brandeis along a path where they're going to put in a bike trail. So you can see the old rail tracks and their kind of abandonment and whatnot, and the kind of the derelict space. And then there's just so much potential for transformation.
So you biked on it before it was actually paved?
So we were biking mostly on the roads right next to it. But then seeing the possibility of how great the route will be once it's put in.
You got to think, it's probably, like, think about what that would cost. You got to pave it and then put up some signs and get some paint. I mean, it's probably a little bit more complicated than that, but I don't know. It seems like it's all
a little
you need roll, to do.
Because if you're looking at decommissioned rail lines, I mean, like, the good thing is that in terms of space, the area's already been flattened because it's got to be for a train.
Yeah.
And on top of that, like, you know, it's cleared and it's really just sort of paving over or removing some of the iron, you know, of the,
exactly.
of the bars.
A lot of the work's already been done in terms of raising the land.
Right.
So, you know, there's less of a water problem. This also speaks, I think, to the film Urbanized Again, where they talk about the High Line in Manhattan and how, you know, this was an old, raised up, overground, train line. And they initially just wanted to tear the whole thing down because it'd been so unsightly. But then, a couple residents went up and walked on it and they noticed that nature had just kind of taken over already. And there was this beautiful, kind of grasslands on top of this derelict building. And they redesigned it into this, you know, beautiful pedestrian walkway.
It's a great place to visit.
There's so much potential to engage these particular wastelands and then transform them at a lower cost than just tearing them down and starting from scratch.
Yeah. And it really speaks to sort of ideas of how development even works. Because up through the 1950s, I mean, even like how development discourse worked in any country of like, do we need to bring in and go build a dam? We got to bring in economic infrastructure, whatever, was premised on the exact term you just used in terms of it being seen as a wasteland, right? As there's nothing there that we can then we have to then turn around and make it economically viable. It's interesting then to take that idea and apply it now, saying, well, we've got these old train lines that since we stopped using them, which is dumb anyway. It's not, you know, maybe not dumb, but like there's reasons we didn't use them. But decommissioned train lines, I mean, a lot of money. That was one of the things that built some of the economic backbone of the U.S. You know, some 150, 200 years ago, putting these things in, and now they're sort of these derelict, unused things because cars have taken over because cars are built individually faster, right? But then seeing these sort of, you know, derelict spaces as wastelands, but then realizing there's so much potential of taking these and transforming them, whether they're into bike lanes or the High Line walkway, which is beautiful. Really well done. Like, I mean, it's super completely. Clean. Like, the train lines here, we could totally do it as well. It's like, it's not, it's just a compelling thing to think about, you know.
It seems it's a much more organic form of development, you know, with everything that entails. And trying to kind of look at, first off, you know, how people in the communities look at the space, what potentials they see. And then, you know, just how you can reutilize what's already there and kind of build from the ground up. So I think, I mean, there's just so many possibilities. And of course, though, with any engagement or with any one view, there are always going to be contrasting views. You know, this particular rail trail project, there's one neighborhood along the line that actually doesn't want it there because some local residents thought that, you know, they don't want noise from people talking. I guess bicycling. Even though they live right near a train line where there's a lot of noise.
There's a lot of noise from a train.
So it's interesting. I mean, I guess, you know, one thing that anyone working in planning kind of knows is that if no one's complaining at you, you're not doing your job right. Because there's always going to be, you know, some contrasting views. And that's what a public space is about, right?
Right,
it's about
indeed.
Creating a way for people with desperate opinions to engage each other constructively.
Yeah. That's a great point. No, hopefully, right. Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, that's a public space is a very interesting medium to think through, right? And because you're right, and that's one of these things. I mean, what kind of changes are we going to see? I mean, even here in Boston, right? There's a lot of interesting transportational changes in terms of, like, you know, just, you know, in Somerville they're going to put the Union Square Green Line in extension, but at the same time they're also extending the Somerville bike path from past Union down into Boston. I don't know if you're not from Boston, you don't know what I'm talking about, but the point is they're like doing miles and miles and miles of bike paths that go through. That's just a bike path. That's not on the city streets itself, which is a really interesting extra development if you think about it, because they're doing an extension of the subway or the train line. On top of that, then they're adding a bike path. And there already are sort of bike lanes in the city, so there's really this, you know, there's this perceived need and desire for these public spaces to be turned into, you know, accessible for the walking and stuff. And it's really interesting because Somerville's even using the arguments to say that, like, by increasing the ways people can get around, particularly on this bike path, walk path, and it's a heavily used path. I mean, we've all spent some time in Somerville and seen these paths used all the time. They're awesome during the summertime just to go walk down. As Mayor Kiratone in Somerville is just pointing out that, like, this is actually promotes economic growth, is that if people can get from place to place in ways that feel safe, And also ways that can be perceived as healthy too. You can walk, you can bike, whatever. You know, that's off the main roads.
Rollerblade now too. I've been seeing a lot of bladers.
That's true. That's true. Rollerblades are coming back. You know, maybe they never left, but they're still here.
And I think, this economic point is also a big thing. The idea that if you have a bike path in your house, it actually might raise the value of your house. I mean, and we're also transforming so many different spaces. I mean, even Lake Erie, which was primarily for ferry transport, right? Hmm. And obviously that's not a very cost-efficient form of transportation these days. But they've been putting a bike path right next to it. So, you know, along these different causeways, there's possibility. And then this might actually revitalize an area economically. So, so Ben, you actually live on a house without a parking garage either, right, and everything.
Where I live? Yeah. No, there's no parking. Actually, we don't even live on a road. Mm. We live up a walking path. So let me tell you, ordering Thai food is not easy.
So obviously living there, right, a bike just makes so much more sense for that property versus a vehicle.
Absolutely. No, it's a great thing. Although, you know, some people, if they live in a big apartment building and they have to bring their bike up the steps, that can get annoying, I would imagine. Yeah.
Which is why bike sharing might be such a better possibility, right?
For sure.
Mm-hmm. And bike sharing, it's a really cool thing. And actually, I wanted to bring up a point about bike sharing and sort of the health of bike. It's like one of the things that we can think of is that, I forget now, but doctors can prescribe, you know, so Boston's got the thing called the Hubway you mentioned before, and an annual membership for the Hubway, which is a bike sharing program. You can rent bikes and ride around the city. I think it's something like $80, but in terms of for low-income residents in Boston, the doctors can now prescribe a Hubway prescription for an annual pass for $5. Because the easy recognized benefits of bike riding for your health, I mean, you know, cardiovascular improvement, I mean, it gets your limbs out moving, you know, it's good exercise. And so it's part of these, we're kind of thinking about these questions of access. What do people have access to? And so something even like a bike share, they recognize that it is a good thing, but it's only, you know, $80 is not, it's not nothing, you know. Particularly if you're talking about low-income residents, they can't afford necessarily that. But they realize that this is an important thing. So we're seeing medical facilities respond by saying, we actually would like this to be accessible to everybody, you know, much more so. And $5 a year is obviously much more affordable than $80 for the same service. It's a really interesting idea to think about, even when you're talking about kind of where you live and, like, you know, is it easier to get Thai food or you might as well just go, you know, ride your bike to the Thai restaurant kind of thing. In a similar vein that, like, this is, you know, in a health, it's really kind of an – yeah, I mean, it's sort of a duh thing, but also good to say, right? That this is a perceived healthy activity. It is,
And so much healthier, right, than all the incredibly expensive prescriptions that are often written by physicians.
Yeah, and so I mean, think about a hospital can more easily write off $5 for bike share if they subsidize the other $75 or whatever. You know, they can much easier write that off than paying for Plexor or cholesterol medicine or something. You know, for someone's life for the next 10 years. You know, it's way cheaper, and as well it provides, I mean, a really cool community service too, because it's saying getting more people in this bike share program, you know, getting them to do exercise, be more comfortable out, you know, being a little more heart healthy. It's a very cool thing, you know. I was really surprised when I came across that. It really, you know, struck me as something interesting to think about. But there is these really interesting sort of responses we're seeing to contemporary cycling, I think, and this is one of them that we can use medicine for it. Another conversational point I want to throw out there and then see what you guys think is that NPR did a story today in LA about these groups called bike trains, and LA is notoriously a car friendly city. It's very bike unfriendly. And so in order to promote biking in Los Angeles, what they're doing is these are called bike trains, and there's literally people that are called conductors that go on specified routes from point A to point B to help people get to work. And so usually 5 to 10 people, but they'll come literally pick people up at their house on their bike, show them how to get there, like, you know, 5 or 6 times, you know, throughout the week till they understand how to ride in the city, to give them sort of the street smarts in order to ride your bike. Because even you said too, Ben, when you first got your bike, you were a little nervous, like, and actually I'm now an urban cyclist, partially thanks to inspiration from Ben here. You kind of, you know, talked me into it, and I love doing it, you know, but it's like at first it is scary because it's like, should I get on the road or not? You know, is it a safe thing to do? And of course, it's dangerous. But I mean, so is riding a tricycle, or so is driving a car.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, driving a car is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, but so it's kind of cool to see in LA that there's this move, you know, and it's a voluntary movement to get people to be able to then bike in the city, you know, by showing them how to do it and then taking them, you know, from point A to point B. It's very cool. And these routes that are like on a map, you can say this is bike train route A. You know, of course, drivers don't always agree with that, and the NPR story points out there's actually a woman they interview in there that she gets very frustrated with bikers that she has to slow down when she's a commuter in her car, and has like gone to the extent of like intimidating bikers by kind of like moving over onto them or like really some heroin. It's kind of scary that like, you know, she just seemed to be okay with this in the interview. I was like, you know, like that's, you can kill somebody doing that, you know, but we're thinking about, right? So we're seeing these like these interesting moves to like contemporary. How do we help cycling happen more? So in LA, we're seeing these trains. Here in Boston, we're seeing you can get prescribed a bike. You know,
it's a good prescription.
It is, yeah. You know, yeah. What do you think about this? Two kind of things, but I think like contemporary cycling in the U.S. We do. So this is to me some of the prestige we're seeing come back into bikes, right? Yeah, we're realizing there's good things about it. You know,
for sure. Yeah. I lived in L.A. Years ago, and my initial point was okay, that works, but L.A. is such a sprawled out city that it would still take a long time to get from one side to the other. And when I lived in L.A., I worked 9 miles away from where I lived, and it took me 2 hours to go one way. 2 hours. So that's 4 hours of driving in a day. And at the time, I didn't even consider a bike. I just thought it's the car culture here, so that's what I would do. But you got to think, you will save so much more time and
money.
And money. Yeah, it's like with a car, you're burning money, you're getting fat. With a bike, you're burning fat, you're saving money. So...
Exactly.
So win-win.
Selling bikes.
and you look cool. And the other thing is that if you and something I didn't realize until I started to get into biking is that there are a lot of different biking groups and bike advocacy groups. Mm. And there's the they have this thing every month called I think it's like the bike. What is it called? The bike party ride, where hundreds of bikers get together in Boston and they just flood
I've seen them around Cambridge occasionally. Mm. You'll see, you know, people in all kinds of kind of tricked out bikes and, you know, various things. Even like the big wheeled bikes from back in the 1920s.
I haven't seen those. The one with the small wheel in the back.
Exactly.
The
Those are cool.
I would be terrified going down Mass Ave on that thing. Yeah. I'm just letting you guys know right now.
How do you stop on one of those things?
Yeah.
Jump off?
Yeah. I guess they didn't have very good roads then, so they would never go that fast.
Yeah.
That's a fair point.
The first person to ever ride their bike across the world was this woman. I forget. It was in like the late 1800s, and that's one of the bikes that she rode was one of those big wheeled bikes. I forget her name. We'll put it maybe in the show notes.
Oh yeah.
But there was a really good documentary I watched last year. Boston Bicycle Film Fest that was in Arlington, and they have it every year. I think it's in October, but. One of them was like this mini doc about this woman who did that, and it was amazing to see her go all the way across the world on one of those bicycles. And I was like, wow, if she can do it at that point in time, you know, why can't we just use our bikes on a day-to-day basis? You know?
Oh yeah,
it's a great question to think about. And like, I think you brought up a cool point about bike advocacy groups, right? I mean, you know, you mentioned China a little while ago, and. As I said, like, you know, bike riding has been down there, partially, as we said, because of a prestige issue. But there's actually a group that has just begun that's called Smarter Than Car, that is China's first bike advocacy group, trying to re-educate, like, people. I mean, like, bicycles are actually, they're good things, too. I mean, like, obviously, a car, like, has its own thing, and you can't necessarily change people's minds directly. But the point is advocating that bikers should also have rights in the city, right? And that they should be, you know, treated as just, you know, keep the lanes, it's still good to have them, and like why it's, you know, as we said, heart healthy, the kind of things we've been saying, like it's safer to ride numbers, it's heart healthy, it can be a community building experience, unlike a car that can be isolating, you know. So it's kind of cool. We do see a chunk of those here, as you said, in Cambridge, Somerville, Boston too as well. Like there is like these groups, so it's kind of interesting to see that we're now seeing them spring up in China too. Importantly, the guy that started it is from the UK, I think, so he's not from China, but it's a recognition that we need to see these popping up.
One thing I wanted to add to the LA thing about the guy that's kind of taking people from one place to another.
Right, the trains, yeah.
A lot of people that I talk to, if they don't bike in the city and they were very tentative, I say, well, everyone that became an avid biker or avid urban cyclist, there was always that threshold they had to cross where it's like, this is really scary. I know people who get a hit, but I'm just going to try it and see what happens. And then they do it and they love it and they eventually get comfortable with it. But I think that I consider this guy that you mentioned as sort of like a biking shaman of some kind, where he like slowly kind of allows you into the world. And it's like, no, it's safe. It's fine. Yeah. Just follow the rules of the road and just, you know, go at your own pace. And, you know, it's not a race. Just you'll get there. You know, I think if we had more people or something in place where we can allow people to show it's not that dangerous. Mm. And I mean, even if you get a hubway, it's still like, here are the bikes. Here, you know, you pay your $2, whatever it is. Good luck. It's like there's still no, you know, help from somebody kind of like letting you know that it's like
safe.
It's very necessary to kind of put a human face on this. And also advocacy in general, I think right now in so many countries all over the world where you have car-centric cultures, advocacy is so important because it's from the grassroots that we build the demand. And then, you know, once the demand is there and once there's public action, you get officials in place who are bike friendly and then they put in these proposals. So it's a very, it's kind of a long process, but you have to start somewhere, you know, and it can only get better if you do get engaged, I feel.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a great point. Just think about it. It's so much of these things that we're seeing a lot of public policy, as you said, Anil, like coming into play. And now we're seeing physically roads being transformed. But you're right. Is that like a lot of this begins in the grassroots level. It's sort of what are we the people and what are we looking for in this kind of space? And so you do see when you see advocacy groups, I think it's really inspiring and interesting of different kinds, you know, different stripes of seeing how do we sort of help urban cycling in this way become more of a mainstream way of being. But also it's interesting because we're seeing the tipping point happen here in Boston anyway, right? As you said, we've risen up in sort of bike friendly cities and like different groups. You said like there's the Boston Bike Party. This other one I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned before, but I thought it'd be fun to talk about this magical mystery bike tour. There's sort of a fun community activity that we see happen here in Boston.
Yeah. So there's this thing. It's called the Commonweals Bicycle Co-op, which is a really cool thing where they just have this place where they have all the tools. You bring your bike in. And for free, I'm pretty sure it's for free, you just walk in and they just give you the tools and they kind of teach you how to fix your bike. And it's a beautiful thing because bike maintenance is a daunting thing. I mean, when I first started to do it, I am certainly not I know enough to get by, but I certainly couldn't like build a bike from scratch or anything like that. But maybe one day. So it's like if something breaks, I'll just figure out how to fix it myself. And then now I have a new skill, but, you bring your bike into this place and they just teach you what you need to know. And then, there are just helpful people and you'll find, getting involved in just the biking community. People are very friendly, very eager to give out information. And they're great. You can find them on Facebook, I think Commonweals, Bicycle Co-op. But what's great is that they put on these different things. Like, I think that they're related to the bike party, that we mentioned earlier, but last Friday, I heard about this. It's called like super secret mystery ride or something like that, or something along those lines. And essentially, all the description was 10 or so miles of biking to mystery spots where there will be music played by random bands. And then at the end, we're going to have a party. It was like, I'm in. So a friend of mine went down and we checked it out. And there were maybe 100 to 120 people or so. And we did about 10 miles and it was great. It was a really long train. It was kind of like that game Snake, where you had to go in a line and not eat your own tail kind of thing. But we would just bike around. The first place we went to was this park somewhere in Alston and this band was playing. They were awesome. Just sitting there chilling and, then biked around and then went to another spot and it was at a playground at like 9:30 PM and everyone was just cool, just chilling. We're all just watching this woman play on a ukulele. And then the last spot was at the – actually, you know, I'm not going to give much more information if you want to check it out. There might be some other things like that in the future. But it was a lot of fun. And then at the end, they gave away free burritos and free beer. And it was like a dream, really. Oh, it was my favorite thing in the world. So
I think we see so many potentials, you know, switching over to bikes for different social engagements, different engagement with public space generally. And I think even with our material culture, I mean, I think throughout this episode, we mentioned a lot of instances of people, you know, moving stuff, right? So, you know, there's the scene of someone packing everything in the car and you have a lot of space in the car versus how do you pack everything in on your bike? And what you've been saying, Ben, about how you need to be a bit more minimalist and really think about what you have. And I think in the States generally, right, we have a large consumerist culture. A lot of people just end up with so much stuff they never use. And just massive piles of it, right? So in a way, by going over to bicycles, we could almost help to make people really think critically about the objects that they own and, you know, if they really need it or not. So just looking generally in society and looking at, you know, improving the efficiency of our material culture, I think could be a huge benefit.
Yeah, sure.
And I think as well as actually this, it reminds me of what you mentioned last week, Anil, but we can sort of bring it up again just at the end of the show, is that you're right and about these, like, thinking critically about our, you know, how we move ourselves around the world. But the big question, your kind of point you brought up last time too, is that, like, it is people powered in that way, right? We can, you know, by becoming informed citizens, we can actually make these kinds of differences, right? Not only to think critically, but also to literally change the infrastructure of our cities.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We have the power to do these things. It's very cool. I mean, a different example, but something to think about, too, is this the idea of, like, the Mumbai Greenway or Bombay Greenway idea. And the idea with that is to sort of change something like 122 kilometers of train lines that we're seeing in Somerville, you know, the same kind of idea in Bombay, to make it sort of this, like, huge open bike paths, transportation space to get people from in and out of the city in a much less congested way. I mean, this is a people-powered project. I mean, the proposal hasn't gone through yet, but it's something that's worth paying attention to. In that, again, these things can be people-powered, right? And this is a massive infrastructural change.
Oh yeah, I mean, it seems in the project, right, they're going to go all the way up and down,
yeah,
the peninsula of Bombay. And so, I think it would be incredible. I mean, especially because Bombay is one of those cities also where you have lots of socioeconomic inequality side by side. So in creating some sort of a transit environment where everyone's engaging each other equally, you know, it's not a road where some people are in a rickshaw and some people are in a Mercedes and an Aston Martin, where everyone can be on bicycles together, it would be a very powerful thing, I think, in promoting socioeconomic equality.
I've met a lot of friends just from biking. And my friend Justin actually met his wife in a biking group in Somerville, and now they're happily married, and it's like a great thing. So you'll find a lot of nice people that share a lot of that you can share a lot of things with, you know, as far as like sustainability and you know, self-sufficiency, that sort of stuff. You know, it's like where your values lie, I guess.
See, so there we even can see social reproduction through cycling, creation of the next generation of families and whatnot through this new transportation and social space. It could be a brave new world.
Brave new recycling, yeah. Right?
Exactly. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming back on the show. Hope to have you again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. If anybody wants to follow my travels and follow what I'm doing, you can check out my website. It's Bengebo, BENGEBO.com, or on Twitter or Instagram or anything. It's just at Bengebo, one word, no spaces.
Very standardized.
Yeah.
Very simple to
remember.
I'm
lucky I have a unique name in that regard.
Exactly right. And, of course, we'll link to your website here on ours on thisantherlife.com.
Exactly. Check everything out, guys.
Sure, love we can, yeah.
Thanks again.
There you go. Well, yeah, have a good week, guys. We'll catch you all here next week. Same time, same place, same airwaves here at WBRS. Signing out, this is Anil Tripathi.
This is Adam Gamble.
This is Ben Gebo.
Have a good week, guys.
See you soon.